Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded. I will be standing by if you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Baron Soka. You may begin.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks to everybody who's joining us today. We're going to give you a quick overview. We'll be walking through what's likely to happen, take questions about the overall political landscape, then walk through the major litigation and how we see that playing out, take questions about legal issues specifically, and then walk through what the FCC actually did and didn't say yesterday, what the rules might look like, what our questions are, and then open up for a general Q&A about that or anything else you want to talk about, including muni broadband and the other issues that are likely to be on the agenda for the February 26th meeting. So in summary, we encourage you to ask questions about politics in the first session, about legal issues in the second Q&A, and then any other questions you have in the general discussion. So I'll give you a quick overview. Jeff Manny, my colleague from the International Center for Law and Economics, and I are going to tag team on this. So don't worry, you won't listen to either one of us monologue for too long. But just to set the table here for our general overview, as we said in our release yesterday, we really see Tom Wheeler having flip-flopped on his two key promises. First is that when he was in his confirmation, he was specifically asked by Senator Thune whether he would return to Congress and seek guidance if the SEC lost in court, and the SEC did lose, and of course, he's refused to do that. That's not surprising. Much more surprising is last May, he specifically said that interconnection would be a different matter for a different proceeding, and yet has rolled interconnection right into this proceeding, despite having a very thin record on that. He's moved the goalposts in several other ways. First, as we'll discuss, is this catch-all provision that the commission slipped in and is only briefly described in their fact sheet. Not clear exactly what that means, but that could be quite a large grab by the SEC of additional authority. And, of course, Title II Lite has just grown from merely sections 201, 202, and 208 to four more sections, and we'll talk about those and what they cover. And, of course, there is always the potential, as our friends at Public Knowledge have reminded us, for unforbearance for Tom Wheeler or any future chairman to decide to move the goalposts yet again. So, in summary for us, there's always the chief problem here has always been that net neutrality would be about far more than just some minimal protections. It would always be, as our friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation put it, a Trojan horse. And we're just waiting for the next flip-flops or expansions of the FCC's authority. And that could cover edge providers or other services, but it's very clear that what's really driving all of this, and will drive this in the future, is political pressure. It's also worth mentioning at the outset here that while Wheeler said he wasn't going to apply universal service fund taxes on broadband, he can't stop states from doing so. So that would be entirely up to Congress and whether the Tax Freedom Act actually covers all state taxes or whether it still allows states to impose some fees, which is not clear. We think the FCC is likely to lose in court. I'll explain that briefly, but for us, as we've said before, legislation really is the answer, but we should be realistic about its chances, and our bottom line on all of that, as we'll walk through, is that this probably does take the wind out of the sails of getting anything passed or at least signed by the president until after litigation has concluded. And then finally, we just highlight our general concerns about the lack of transparency here. Wheeler could have shared the draft order. He didn't do so. He simply outlined it in a way that really raises more questions than it answers. So Jeff, before I get into legal issues, let me turn things over to you to lay out what happened yesterday.
Okay, thanks, Baron. So just very quickly, because you guys all probably know most of this, obviously Wheeler released his op-ed and an FCC fact sheet purporting to lay out what will be in his proposal to regulate net neutrality, the open internet. I think it's fair to say that neither says very much, whether that's calculated or just a a function of how the process typically goes is not entirely clear, but we do think that in part the not saying very much is itself somewhat politically calculated. I think at the same time, we can learn from the fact sheet and the op-ed itself that there really is a political motivation behind all of this. And let me just give a couple of examples why I think that. First, as you may or may not have noticed, one of the things that Wheeler did in setting the stage for this was telling a story about his experience with NABU, which was an early effort to provide consumer access to internet-like services. And his story of the failure of NABU lays the blame at the feet of the cable systems, which NABU tried to connect to, and claimed that they were closed systems and prevented his service from getting off the ground. The reality is very different than that. NABU wasn't thwarted by a lack of access, but by a lack of demand for its services. And before it went under, it did in fact have agreements with many cable operators. NABU required a dedicated server-based system at a time when the move to personal computers was really ascendant. It was itself a closed system, and it's pretty clear that it failed for lack of consumer demand, not for lack of cooperation with cable systems. Another point that Wheeler made in trying to defend the need for his proposal was to defend the lack of problems that will arise from his proposals, was that wireless investment hasn't been driven by common, sorry, was that wireless investment proceeded apace, even though, according to Wheeler, wireless was regulated under Title II. He cited the years, I think, 1993 to 2009, and said that the companies made $300 million of investment then. But his claims here are inaccurate or even dissembling. The reality is that while during all that time, indeed, mobile voice services were regulated as a Title II common carrier, mobile data services were not. And it's very clear that the vast, vast majority of that investment was driven by mobile data, not by mobile voice. And that's the service that is now going to be regulated. So the reference to the kind of investment that happened in a world in which mobile voice was regulated as a Title II service really isn't particularly instructive for what's going to happen going forward. I think the point is that these are both sort of self-serving revisionist history on Wheeler's part, and it just shows that the actual evidence to support the kind of regulations that are being proposed here is very weak. The fact sheet dodges a lot of key questions. It simply asserts that the FCC has, quote, strong legal arguments to defend its positions. We'll talk about these more later, but these are really the key to understanding the basis of authority here, which is, of course, the central question about the likely success or failure of these rules. And they're what Wheeler should be sharing with the community at this point, that he didn't also suggest to us some likelihood that his strong legal arguments aren't as strong as he suggests. Excuse me. All right, so what's going to happen next? Obviously, the very next thing is that the full proposal will be shared with the members of the commission, and in theory, the proposal will be refined through conversations with the other commissioners before they're released to the public. We can assume that there will be no contributions accepted from the Republican commissioners. Recent experience makes that very clear, that Wheeler is not interested in listening to his Republican colleagues or taking their advice. The Democrats may have input, and in some sense, at the end of the day, this whole thing stands in Clyburn's and Rosenworcel's hands. We'll talk a little bit more about their incentives here, and it could get dialed back on the margins, but at the same time, Wheeler has put stakes in the ground over the most important points here, and it's extremely unlikely that conversations with Clyburn and Rosenworcel are going to roll back any of the key provisions outlined here. I want to make one more quick point to clear up some confusion I've seen in people's comments about what happened to stock prices immediately following the release, and then I'll turn it back over to Barron. It's been noted on several occasions that I've seen in the media and on social media, that there was a sharp increase in share prices following the release, and that this shows that the investor community doesn't think that these rules will be a problem. In fact, that they will help the ISPs. We have to be very careful deriving much from casual empiricism. Stock prices change for many reasons. By far the biggest increases were at Comcast and Time Warner Cable. And it's quite likely that's attributable to the expectation that implementing Title II also happens to mean that the Time Warner Comcast merger is more likely to go through. That those two things are tied together is actually a failure of policy, not a reason to celebrate. Also, of course, when looking at stock price changes, the relevant change is the change from previous expectations. All this really shows, if the stock price movements are attributable to the announcement, is that the proposal here isn't as bad as expected. Maybe that's because rate regulation looks to be less likely, according to what was released yesterday. But that's a far cry from saying the proposal actually bolsters these stock prices. It's simply a statement that expectations were a little bit lower than they should have been. So let me turn it back over to Baron now.
Sure. So we'll take questions on politics, but let me just wrap up by explaining what we think is likely to happen next. Of course, the vote happens on February 26th. The FCC will likely that day simply publish an overview and the statements by the commissioners, and then we'll see how long it takes them to put the order out. In 2010, they put the order out in 2 days. They were ready to do it and ready to go. This time, they could do that, or they could wait weeks or even months, as sometimes happens with FCC orders. And that's especially true if there is actually negotiation going on in the background. But once the order itself comes out, it will still be another potentially few months before it's published in the Federal Register. In 2011, that took 10 months. And nobody can file a legal challenge until the publication of the Federal Register has occurred. For political reasons, it seems pretty likely to us that the FCC will release the order quickly and will try to get the Office of Management and Budget to approve the publication of the Federal Register quickly. So in terms of chronology, we'd figure that a lawsuit would likely start at the earliest, say by perhaps May or June, and would likely take at least a year to be resolved. Verizon and AT&T have said that they would sue. It is possible that there could be an injunction granted. It's also possible that the parties would ask, instead of having an injunction, simply to have accelerated briefing. But whatever exactly happens, the point is that a decision, the initial appellate decision, would likely come down probably between May and October of next year at the earliest, but it could potentially come down after the election or even into the next presidency. So to wrap up, the bottom line for us is that this is really first and foremost about politics and always has been. It seems to us that this looks to the White House like a win-win. They get to talk tough about net neutrality, which is clearly a winning issue for them, clearly something that Republicans have not learned to message very well. And if they lose in court, they simply get to dial up that machine, and those groups that have built an entire apparatus of donations and political influence around this simply get to go up the fight once again. If the FCC wins in large part, they can pat themselves on the back. But if the FCC does lose and they have to go back to Congress to negotiate, I don't think they'll have lost much. They'll probably get at least as good a deal as they would have gotten today. So we'll just wrap up here on politics, but it does seem like the White House is pursuing a policy that's driven largely by politics, but that is on some level rational, that they may figure that either they will have another opportunity after a decision comes down towards the end of their presidency to resolve this, or that this problem will simply be kicked on to the next administration, and it won't be their problem. So we're going to take questions now about politics. If you have anything to ask here about anything we've said thus far or how this plays out politically, please ask them now. But if you have questions about what the actual litigation will look like, we'll turn to those topics next and then take questions on that and then finish by just discussing what the order seems likely to look like and taking a general Q&A. So if you have any discussion here, any questions, please feel free to ask them now.
At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone, and we'll pause a moment to allow questions to queue.
And while we're doing that, Jeff, do you have anything to add to what I said?
No, I mean, the only thing I would add, I mean, everyone knows this, right, is just to flag the point that's been made many times that so much of this does seem to be driven from the White House, and that's unfortunate for the operations of an allegedly independent regulatory agency. But it does seem very clear that what's happening here is that Wheeler is acceding to the White House's demands, and the real question is, what's going to happen with Clyburn and Rosenworcel? Are they too going to accede to what the president wants here, or are they going to have independent ideas that deviate from Wheeler's proposal such that either they get some amendments put in or some edits to the proposal so it looks different, or conceivably even vote against it?
Any questions from the audience or participants?
And it appears we have no questions at this time.
Okay. And we'll just move through to discuss the legal risk here. So just as an overview, we're going to talk about reclassification and the parts of that and where we think the SEC may be likely to lose, and then move to forbearance, and then take questions about the legal issues. And as I said, we'll then discuss the substance of the order. So, Jeff, if you want to kick things off in discussing what we think is actually newsworthy from yesterday about what the president said, what the chairman said, and how it might factor into litigation.
Yeah, so I think the biggest takeaway is that on reclassification, particularly on wireline reclassification, Wheeler's op-ed declares that his proposal will, quote, modernize Title II, tailoring it for the 21st century. He intends to invoke Title II, and then, as expected, use forbearance to effectively rewrite the law. What's perverse about this and noteworthy about this is that this means forbearance will be used to justify greater regulation, which is the opposite of what Congress intended. The use of the word tailoring is particularly poignant here as well. Just last year, the Supreme Court ruled in Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA that a similar sort of tailoring of the Clean Air Act by the EPA was effectively rewriting the act, in that case to include greenhouse gases as a pollutant, which according to the court was something Congress could not reasonably have intended to allow the agency to do. That sort of statutory rewriting, whether it's through tailoring or something else, is no more permissible here. I think Barron, maybe I'll turn it over to you. Or let me just summarize what I just said.
I would just summarize that by saying that I think you'll see that line turn up in the court's decisions about this. The courts have, in the past, said that where they do draw the lines, where agencies rewrite statutes to deal with extremely important issues of grave importance. This is precisely the line the Supreme Court used.
Right.
Utility Air Regulatory Group, the EPA. And Wheeler has really just hung himself with his words. He, in addition to what he said yesterday in his op-ed, he's previously at the January meeting, he declared with very grand rhetorical effect that this was the most powerful network in the history of mankind, offering transformational opportunities we can't even imagine at this point in time. And really impressing upon everybody the importance and gravity of the FCC's decisions, all those words will come back to bite him when it actually comes to court. And it's going to be very easy for the courts to say, for Verizon and AT&T, whoever else challenges this, that's essentially what the FCC is doing. They're fundamentally rewriting or tailoring Title II to deal with something that Congress didn't intend. And that forbearance perversely will end up being used as a way of achieving greater regulation rather than reducing regulation.
Right.
So that is the key overarching legal question before the agency. But that's even on top of underlying legal questions along the lines of, can the agency actually justify its changed interpretation? Wheeler made a big deal yesterday about saying that broadband providers that no longer offer the same bundle that consumers expected from them 10 years ago, and the consumer expectations have changed. That's a convenient talking point for the agency, but as a legal matter, I think it's going to be fairly easy for Verizon and AT&T to show that that broadband is essentially the same set of offerings today that it was 10 years ago. And those who are consistently relying on Justice Scalia's views on this back in the Brand X case forget that he was in the minority. So it's not by any means clear that the FCC will actually win on explaining its change in the classification of broadband. But let's assume this for the moment that they do, and that they get around the problem of utility air regulatory group and the earlier decision of Brown and Williamson. It's going to be very difficult for the FCC to win on reclassifying wireless broadband. Jeff alluded to this earlier. This is one of the areas where the chairman has been, frankly, dishonest. At Vegas, he claimed that he helped to write Section 332, which governs wireless services, but didn't even mention that Section 332 draws a completely, a very sharp line and offers completely different treatment as between wireless voice service, which, like all voice service, has always been a Title II service on the one hand, and other wireless services on the other that are not, quote, interconnected with the public switched network. The only way the FCC is going to be able to win in this area is to claim that those terms are ambiguous and that they get Chevron deference in redefining them. And we can get into this in Q&A. I think that's a very difficult argument to make, given that the Act clearly uses the term public switch network to refer to the telephone network, in which case you just can't argue that wireless broadband is interconnected, that it is not a private service. So, again, yesterday's fact sheet simply asserts that the FCC has killer legal arguments, but doesn't tell us what they are. So we'll have to wait and see. But the real difficulty the FCC faces is justifying whatever argument it makes on reclassification with forbearance at the same time. The two cut in very different directions. And that really is part of the problem that will lead them into the chainsaw of the utility air regulatory group line of cases about agencies trying to effectively tailor, as Wheeler has put it, their statutes. But we'll just briefly mention some other problems that the agency will deal with in forbearance. And this really gets back to his constant carping about wireless services and how forbearance has actually worked there. So it's worth pointing out, just to begin with, that the situation of wireless services was very different. Gus Hurwitz has a great piece up at Tech Policy Daily this morning that I would encourage all of you to read, that among other things outlines that wireless services really had never been controversial, unlike the great fight now about what to apply, which requirements of Title II to apply to broadband. The market structure has always been very different in terms of the number of players, and the service itself technologically is fundamentally different. Wireless service is a fairly integrated service that is quite distinguishable from wireline broadband service and much more subject to the needs of network management operators or operators for network management. And of course, since the FCC went through the experience of forbearance with wireless services, it has made forbearance essentially impossible in markets with only one or two players. That was the point of the Phoenix Quest decision, where the FCC refused to grant forbearance. So the FCC would have a difficult time changing its justification for forbearance without opening the door to blanket forbearance by future Republican administrations, both with regard to those parts of Title II the FCC is implying today, but also to the rest of the Act. The FCC, by tinkering with forbearance, really puts in jeopardy their ability to hold on to provisions of the Act across many other issues, including traditional voice services that they want to keep in place. So it's hard to see them really being able to square the circle. And then finally, there is one market, and that is the market that they claim is a terminating access monopoly as between broadband providers on the one hand and edge providers on the other. If that's truly a monopoly, as the FCC says, how can the FCC forbear at all from the core requirements of Title II? And if they can, as Larry Spiewak and George Ford have repeatedly outlined, that would mean not only imposing the rest of Title II, but indeed the general principle of Title II that parties have to pay for terminating their traffic, which would mean, in practice, that edge providers, or at least the peering companies that carry their traffic, would have to pay broadband providers for terminating that traffic, which would be a sender pays regime. That would be the very opposite of net neutrality. All of this is going to be hashed out in court. And I'd like to take questions here, but while we're filling up the queue, and I believe that's star one, if Jeff wants to add anything on the legal issues here, please do so.
Yeah, I just wanted to amplify something that Barry was saying. It's particularly inappropriate to use the experience with wireless to justify what's going on here today for the two reasons. One is this forbearance issue. In the wireless case, as Barron points out, wireless voice was always regulated, like typical voice services, under a Title II regime. And forbearance in that realm was indeed a lessening of regulation. It was an appropriate use of the forbearance process as laid out by Congress. To then refer to that here in the effort to justify the initial application of a Title II regime to mobile or even wired data services is wholly inapposite. And then the second point, the one that Barron was just mentioning, is that while it may be inappropriate for the FCC to consider wired and wireless communications as being in separate markets, indeed they have tended to do that, and they are, in that respect, different markets, whereas there may or may not, but at least according to the FCC, there is a terminating monopoly in the wired market. It's very hard to make that claim in the wireless space. And so the justifications for applying the rules in the wireline space, according to their assessment of the markets, may be greater, but that makes it very difficult to justify the application of the rules in the wireless space.
Right, and again, the point here is simply that the arguments for forbearance on the one hand and reclassification on the other, they'll all be in the same order. They're all going to be challenged together, apparently, and the FCC is going to have to reconcile them. So we have some questions. Please, Mr. Operator, if you could take them now.
We'll take our first question from John Egerton with Multichannel News. Your line is now open.
Hey, guys, can you explain to me why this might make the Comcast Summer Cable approval more likely?
Yeah, it's pure politics, I think. Perhaps there's a more substantive sort of explanation for this, but I'm not sure what it would be. I think basically all along, it's been made clear, perhaps explicitly to those companies, but implicitly in various things the FCC has said, that the two dockets were tied together. And to put it, my interpretation has always been the FCC was very unlikely to ever approve the merger if they didn't apply Title II regulations to cable. In other words, you could get one without the other, and perhaps that meant that even if they, that the merger would be thwarted if they weren't able to apply Title II in the net neutrality docket. But this sort of outcome was always sort of seemingly an implicit offer by the FCC. If we regulate you as Title II, sort of in exchange for that, again, not explicitly that I know of, we're more likely at least to allow the merger to go through. I don't think that they're legitimately tied together in any real way. It's just a matter of politics as I see it. Okay.
Well, I would just add to that there is a substantive connection in that what will likely happen, I think, is that the FCC is likely to impose the same rules exactly as it did in the Comcast Universal merger. They'll impose the same rules on the merged company as merger conditions, so that if they do lose in court, they'll at least be able to say that we've got the biggest player in the market covered.
Okay.
And Jeff, did you want to add something on interconnection there?
If you tried to find a substantive tie between them, it might be in the interconnection realm, and it may very well be, if we're giving the FCC a lot of credit, that they feel like the merger has the potential to do less damage if interconnection is regulated under strong net neutrality type rules. Again, I don't know that to be the case, but it could very well be that that's how they view the connection between the two. So now applying Title II rules to interconnection, maybe they feel like there's less risk from the merger.
John, does that answer your question?
That does indeed. One other thing, and that is, can you go through what, briefly again, the timeline? I mean, you think it'll be months to get this published in the register? Don't they sometimes do it like in 3 or 4 weeks?
Well, it's up to the agency and to the White House. My understanding in 2011 was that there were some genuine Paperwork Reduction Act problems raised at the Office of Management and Budget. And so, look, as much as this is driven about politics, there are also real issues here, and that the more burdensome the rules are, the more that the good folks over at OMB, who I think are as immune from political pressure as anybody could be inside any administration, the more likely they may be to ask some difficult questions, and they may draw this out no matter how much pressure is brought to bear on them. But let's say best case scenario, it is certainly possible the FCC could issue the order itself, even the day of the vote or a few days after or within a few weeks. And it's possible that publication could occur, if I was perhaps within a month. But it's hard for me to see how the order gets published in less than a month, probably in less than 2 months from the vote.
Well, I would just say on the Paperwork Reduction Act issue, the fact that they did go through this before suggests that, assuming they do want it to come out sooner than later, and I think there's good reason to think they do, that they'll be prepared for those issues this time around, and I think it's a lot less likely that we'll see delays arising from the OMB.
But I think, John, to your question, I think probably more important to the timeline than whether it takes OMB a few weeks or more to publish is going to be the questions that we alluded to of what happens in the litigation. Is it assigned quickly to one court? When it gets there, do the parties insist on fighting about an injunction, or do they get an accelerated briefing schedule instead? It's really hard to predict any of those things. So I would just, again, summarize by saying that it just seems likely to us, based on the appellate lawyers that we've talked to, that at the earliest you might see a decision next year, perhaps around May, but it could drag on. Wherever it falls, it seems likely to me it's going to fall as the election is heating up. And I think that's part of the point here, that if that happens, it can only help Democrats. And if it comes after the election, then at least they can kick this can down the road, and maybe that means trying to actually negotiate over legislation at the very end of the administration, or maybe it means simply kicking the issue over to the next president, and that in turn may depend on who wins the election.
Do you think the Republicans will come out with something like, you know, a bad dog resolution of disapproval or something like that?
Well, the Congressional Review Act, which you call bad dog, it really is sort of toothless, because it only works if you have the president on board or a two-thirds majority in either chamber. So I don't think that's a productive strategy for Republicans. If Republicans are really serious about this, and I think they are, well, what I think you'll see them do is work this through regular order, offer do multiple hearings and a markup, and give Democrats a chance to come to the table and offer amendments, and then vote both of these bills out of committee. And I think I have every reason to expect that this will ultimately pass the House, just as, and I always remind people about this, a net neutrality fix, indeed a fix for muni broadband as well, were both part of the 2006 Communications Act update that passed the House with 215 Republicans, which was almost everyone. There were a few not voting. And 102 House Democrats, which was the majority of their caucus. So they voted for that by a two-thirds majority. And that went to the Senate, and it got through the Senate Commerce Committee, and it just didn't get floor action. So this isn't crazy. We've already seen this happen before. And the question, really, that you're asking, John, is where do Republicans go with this? And I think that they have an incentive. If they can get a few Democrats on board to get this out of committee, the next big question will be, can they actually get to 60 votes? And if they do, they really force the administration's hand.
That's a big problem, though, of course, is that you know, with this kind of proposal on the table, clear support from the administration, or I should say, clear support by the FCC of the administration, Democrats have very little incentive to offer much by way of compromise. And one can certainly imagine that the kind of bill that could possibly get 60 votes is not the sort of bill that the Republicans would want to push at the end of the day. So while there is certainly some movement in that direction by the Republicans, there's only so much they're going to be willing to give up. And I would say that it's quite likely that the events of yesterday suggest you'll give a lot of strength to the Democrats' hand in negotiation there, and maybe so much so that any kind of legislative compromise is going to be extremely difficult to reach.
Or at least delayed. I mean, the most likely scenario is whatever Republicans do, putting it through the House, even putting it through the Senate Commerce Committee, if they can get a few votes, which I think they probably could. What does seem most likely is that any floor action on the Senate would probably be delayed until the litigation came down. And if Democrats lose, or if the FCC loses, at least in significant part, they're finally then going to have an incentive to come to the table. Some of them may still hold out for the Supreme Court to change whatever the decision might be. But at that point, and this is why I think this is just a win-win for them, why they really have no incentive to negotiate now, I don't think they'll have lost anything, because they'll probably get at least as good a deal then as they would get now. And if they're really smart, they'll play good cop, bad cop. They'll have a few Democrats on, for example, the Senate Commerce Committee, work with Republicans and move the bill further to the left in exchange for getting out of committee, so that what's actually on the table by the time we get there is something that Democrats like more. Anyway, we have a few other questions. Let's take those, and then we'll move on to just covering briefly the substance of the of what was discussed yesterday, and then open it up to general Q&A about anything else anybody wants to discuss. So any other questions about politics, legal issues and their tie-in to politics?
We'll take our next question from the line of Gordon Krovitz with Wall Street Journal. Your line is now open.
Hey, thanks, guys, for taking the time to do this. You may be planning to cover this later, and if so, that's fine. Setting aside the issues about what's going to happen next and the legal issues around this, which I think are terrific issues, what will happen, practically speaking, in the next year or 18 months, assuming there's no injunction against this reclassification? And in particular, how will it be different for potential new broadband providers like a Google Fiber to enter the market with Title II applying to them?
It's a great question, Gordon. Thank you. So the legal answer is the rules will go into effect probably 60 days after their publication in the Federal Register, which, as we were saying earlier, could be as early as this summer. The FCC is probably going to have additional proceedings about how to implement what it is they're proposing. So what you're likely to see happen at the agency is, first of all, someone will file a petition for reconsideration. The agency doesn't have to deal with that, but they may, and that may foreshadow what the litigation will look like. And then simultaneously, on parallel tracks, the agency will have to start figuring out how it's actually going to apply the various provisions of Title II that it's authorized today. And those will, and for example, that would include things like privacy and data security. And so essentially all of those issues will be transferred overnight from the Federal Trade Commission, where they are dealt with on a case-by-case basis, where the FTC, even though it doesn't have formal rules, has been very active, those will be transferred over to the FCC, which will have to figure out how to deal with them in a regulatory fashion. So all of that will start moving, and will probably move fairly slowly. I suspect the agency, it could go one of two ways. It could generally try to downplay enforcement for fear that it may run into additional legal chainsaws about how it's applying the rules, or it could, if they think it's politically convenient, they could get fairly aggressive and just throw their lot to the court. Hard to say exactly what will happen, but the agency will be quite busy having to deal with this while also having to battle Congress. You asked a particular question about Google Fiber. If there is one silver lining in all of this, I would say that it's that the chairman is extending the pole attachment rules to broadband companies more generally. I actually think that's a good idea. I'd like to see Congress do that. I'm sorry that it's happening this way, but it's certainly crazy that Google Fiber would get a different treatment, or that the prices that you pay the local utility vary according to whether you're a telecom or a broadband company or Google Fiber. So that, if anything, may help. And that's the only thing Google said here that's positive or encouraging. But more generally, I think you've seen this from broadband companies like Cedar Falls, Iowa, the very company that Obama went to visit to praise Muni Broadband. They've expressed their concerns that the burdens of Title II would fall most on small broadband providers.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is the most likely, you're probably not going to see a lot of actual enforcement action by the FCC in the next 12 months. I think they're going to be very busy trying to figure out what that's supposed to look like. But I think you will see companies trying to anticipate what the FCC is going to do and changing their organizations and procedures accordingly. And to the extent that really plays out in any appreciable way, it's mostly going to happen for these small ISPs, some of whom I think will probably lose some of their expectations around investment in particular, and probably some of them will shutter, perhaps not in the next 12 months, but that's certainly a predictable outcome of this.
And unfortunately, Gordon, the biggest cost here is going to be unseen. It's the small companies that, and I've talked to some of these folks that are trying to deploy, that will be discouraged from doing so, and that we'll never see by the double whammy of Title II and also the FCC trying to authorize competition from government-owned networks that ultimately have the backing of taxpayers and significant advantages over small private providers. Any other final questions on these legal issues before we finish the last round here?
We'll take our next question from John Mello with Tech News World. Your line is now open.
So during the period when we have all this manipulation and running around with the court suit and nothing happening, who's going to be harmed doing this? Who's going to be harmed?
Well, I think, as we just said, most obviously it'll be the small ISPs that are scrambling to try to anticipate what the rules are ultimately going to look like, on the expectation that, a realistic expectation that, of course, the courts might not strike down the rules. So I think most obviously in the near term, if I had to point my finger at anyone, it would be the small ISPs.
And what about net neutrality? Net neutrality just fades into the background. It doesn't seem to even enter into the picture here. It's all this other. It seems like it's just left in limbo.
Well, I'd say for my part that net neutrality has always been rather a specious justification for the real agenda, which is getting the FCC larger authority. That there simply isn't a demonstrated track record of problems. We haven't really had any enforcement matters, even when the rules were in effect. I don't think we're likely to have any problems going forward. All that will really have changed here is that the FCC will have taken away the Federal Trade Commission's ability to enforce the consumer protection laws, the antitrust laws. And then, most importantly, the FTC's potential to enforce what I think has been the best answer all along, which would be a multi-stakeholder code of conduct. We could have had that hammered out years ago. The FTC could have enforced it. That's not going to happen now that we go down this road. I would just add to what Jeff mentioned, the other unseen cost here is going to be consumers on the margins. So if you live in an area that's not particularly profitable, broadband companies are likely simply to delay investment in your area. And that most likely means that the telephone companies that have been starting the process of upgrading their DSL networks are likely to simply delay those investments, just as cable companies delayed their investments in upgrading to cable modem after the 1992 Cable Act. You're likely to see a slowdown in investment. And so ironically, if anything, that really helps, perhaps helps cable companies most by protecting them from competition. We have a few more questions. I'm going to just try to get through these quickly so we can wrap up here. So please, if we can take the next question.
Our next question is from John Miley with Kiplinger. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, you might have answered it a little bit, but just some of a legal question. So they're reclassifying it, as you can glean from the fact sheet, reclassifying it in Title II, and then they're using 706 authority to put in the net neutrality rules?
Well, it seems like a belt and suspenders approach. In other words, they're reclassifying, but also grounding things on 706 as fallback. I will say on the reclassification point, the fact sheet, if you look at the first bullet on page one of the fact sheet, is rather confusing. But as far as we can tell, what they're really saying is that they're reclassifying retail and they're reclassifying on the back end. And so it's the hybrid approach plus full reclassification. So we'll see what the order actually looks like. But the point is, the commission is trying to protect itself from losing in court. So we've been focused mostly on Title II. I'll just very briefly say about Section 706 that very shortly after the decision came down last year, we expressed our concerns about Section 706 in a piece in Wired that we'll share with all of you. But we continue to believe that Section 706 is at least as great a danger to the Internet overall as Title II is, because the FCC reinterpreted it in 2010 as not being a command to use other sources of authority, as it had thought since 1998, but simply to say that the FCC can regulate any form of communications so long as it claims that doing so somehow promotes broadband and it's not specifically illegal. So that opens the door to regulation of not just net neutrality, but any number of things. As a legal matter, that issue is going up to the Supreme Court right now. The Tenth Circuit last year approved the FCC's reinterpretation of 706 very, very briefly, and it's being challenged now. It's possible the FCC could lose on those grounds, and that same issue could also come up, will come up, in a Muni Broadband case. So we'll see, but it's possible the FCC could go home with nothing here. Jeff, you want to add anything quickly before we go to the next question?
Yeah, I think the question suggests maybe some confusion about what's happening here. I think net neutrality is enforced under Sections 201 and 202 of Title II that preclude unjust and unreasonable practices. I think they are also suggesting that if for any reason that fails, the attempt to reclassify fails, they can maintain the exact same rules by reference to their authority under Section 706. But in either case, net neutrality is being enforced here. It's just a question of whether it's enforced under Title II or 706, or in this case, both, if either fails.
But there is perhaps a little bit of obfuscation here, because remember, the chairman himself told Congress last May that even under Title II, the FCC can't categorically ban all paid prioritization, which Congress could do, but the FCC under Title II has to allow people to recover their costs. So it is possible that part of the vagueness here and the language about the catch-all is really designed to fudge, so the FCC can try once again, even while it's invoking Title II, to push the envelope as far as it can by being vague as to what it's grounding under 706. So it's really hard to say until we see the order. We're going to do a lightning round here, so if I could take the next question.
The next question is from Carola Balbuena with Telefonic. Your line is now open.
No, thank you. It has already been answered. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right, we'll take our next question from Kerry Murakami with Communications Daily. Your line is now open.
Hi, Baron and Jeff. Look, AT&T and ACA and some others have raised some questions about procedural issues, I'm curious what you think about those.
So they have raised some procedural issues. The FCC just historically has very broad authority to do whatever's in the public interest, but it gets litigated or sued all the time. And more often than not, it loses on procedural issues. And here, it has some pretty serious procedural problems, many of which could have been addressed by issuing a further notice of proposed rulemaking. So just very briefly to highlight, for example, saying that you're not going to deal with interconnection and then suddenly dealing with it raises basic problems of notice that the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act, is designed to deal with to ensure that parties really know what the agency is proposing and that they build an adequate record. So that's one example. There are a few others. Forbearance is the most obvious one. The record for the agency is pretty thin. The chairman would have been on much stronger legal grounds if he had issued a further notice. But for political reasons, he's chosen not to do so. So the short answer to your question, Carrie, is that those issues are going to come up really first and foremost, because the way the courts tend to resolve issues is, first, if you can knock them out on administrative procedural grounds, you do so. And then you go to the statutory grounds that we've been discussing, like the Utility Air Regulatory Group case. And then only if you get through those issues do you get to the fundamental constitutional issues, like the First Amendment, which has not been addressed in any litigation here only because the courts have never actually given the FCC a clear win. So the FCC's got to jump through a lot of hoops to win completely. And you're quite right that that it could lose on any one of those. And if it does, they're going to have to go back for the third time to do this or finally admit that legislation is the better way to address these issues. Jeff's got to go in a minute. So if you have anything to add here before you go, Jeff, please do so.
No, let's take the next questions, and then we can try to get through this before I
we have go. One more question. It's from James Dunstan with Mobius Legal Group. Your line is now open.
Thanks, Baron and Jeff. My question is, I'd like you to kind of drill down a little bit into the impact of the Brand X case and sort of indicate how you think the FCC is going to address that, with a specific implication of if they are going to essentially argue that all of these services are similar now and there isn't any sort of distinction between data and voice, then do we really believe the commissioner when he says that USF contributions aren't going to be applied to data services?
Well, it's an astute question, Jim, because what you're really putting your finger on is that the way that the FCC is most likely to win on justifying reclassification is, as you said, to go broad. And if you go broad and you say, look, these services are all indistinguishable, you've already started down the slippery slope. And you've made it very easy for a future FCC, if not for this one, to either invoke universal service taxes, to unforbear from some of the provisions that they claim they're forbearing from today, or to start expanding the scope of the rules. And so we've already seen the FCC, by covering interconnection, as far as I can tell, a company like Netflix only gets the benefit of the interconnection provisions of the Act if they themselves are subject to Title II. So by bloating the scope of the rules, the FCC is already going down the road of expanding what they're applying Title II to cover other services. And it's not a rhetorical question to say, where will they stop? I really don't know. But I think that Jeff Pulver really put this best, based on his experience dealing with the FCC and trying to get them to refrain from applying Title II to voice over Internet services back in 2002 and 2004, when he said that as soon as we abolish the current line, that the new line really will exist only in the mind of whoever happens to be chairman at the time. And so today it may be broadband and net neutrality, and tomorrow it could be regulating interconnected services like Netflix or VoIP or gaming or telemedicine or who knows what else.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Baron, that's what I was specifically thinking of was the battle over VoIP, which, you know, had a, you know, before 2002 was not subject to USF funds and was really sort of treated more on the data side, and suddenly now it's treated on the voice side, you know, because of the distinction of interconnection with the public switch network. But if that all goes away, then, you know, as you say, that slope gets really slippery and really steep very fast.
Yeah, Jim, I think you're right to focus on the USF question. I think it's a nice compromise that the chairman suggests that USF contribution isn't going to be required here, but it's not one that anyone should think is sustainable for very long. I just don't see the FCC or the those that may pressure it politically forbearing from that massive source of potential revenue for very long. Nor do I see the companies that do have to contribute to USF but are offering services that are identical to what the broadband companies are offering forbearing from encouraging that and ultimately making it happen. And I will say one thing that we haven't really mentioned yet here, but is worth keeping in the back of everyone's mind. Eventually, all of this may be sort of sidelined by a Communications Act rewrite. And so in a few years from now, sort of none of this discussion may be relevant anymore. But up until then, I think that's inevitable.
Well, indeed, this discussion may be what finally prompts a Communications Act update, just as the 96 Act was really Congress's attempt to reclaim authority from the courts, which had ended up having to deal with the mess of the AT&T breakup. Similarly, all these issues are going to be litigated. And they'll be litigated not just because of the FCC, but because of states and because of private litigants. They're taking advantage of Title II's provisions and trying to push the envelope. So I would just predict, like Cassandra, years of devastation and legal uncertainty. And again, summarized by saying that we can resolve all this legislatively. Republicans have come to the table to address these concerns, and that doesn't seem to be good enough for the administration. And as a legal matter, just before I wrap up, I'll just add one more thing, which is at the end of the day, and this is one of the good things to look for all of you reporters when you see the order come out, if the FCC is really, really concerned about losing, they will bootstrap their own justification for Title II by both saying that the circumstances have changed since Brand X and things like DNS are now easier to get from alternative sources, and so broadband is not a bundled service, but also pointing to the nature of the market and saying it is uncompetitive, and in that sense relying on the 25 megabit threshold that the FCC has just issued for its 706 report. And if they do that, it does give them another source of argumentation to justify invoking Title II in addition to the more legalistic ones. But that becomes extremely difficult to reconcile with any argument for forbearance and makes the slippery slope of unforbearance all the more dangerous. Any final questions to wrap up here?
We have no further questions at this time.
Okay, well, we'll just very, very briefly cover just a quick lightning round here. We've already alluded briefly to the things that the commission is not forbearing from, and that notably would be Section 222 of so-called CPNI, Consumer Proprietary Network Information Rules. That's privacy and security. That would, again, essentially replace the FTC's model of regulation, and it's something that the FCC has been encouraged to for a long time, in particular by the Department of Defense, which is very frustrated and likes having neat rules in place, especially over cybersecurity, because, for example, CENTCOM just had their Twitter page hacked, and there's really not anything that they can do about that. They need someone to regulate, and they're frustrated with Congress for not giving the FTC statutory authority to regulate because, in their mind, regulation is the thing that matters, not case-by-case enforcement. So I would expect the FCC to be potentially very aggressive here, and for the new rules, which could really flow through to internet companies that use data that's collected by the companies that are directly subject to the rules, the FCC could end up becoming the not just the privacy and cybersecurity police for broadband, but really for all the apps and services that end up riding on the network. So we'll have to see how they handle those things. I've already mentioned pole attachments. Again, something I think Congress ought to be doing as part of a larger pro-deployment package. Chairman mentioned disability provisions and also universal service. We've covered all of those. Just briefly on the content of the rules, I think it is worth noting that they expand fairly considerably upon the NPRM in a few senses. We discussed adding interconnection and covering not only retail broadband, but also edge provider services, potentially under Title II. There is no commercially reasonable limitation language. The chairman seems to be allergic to that politically because it didn't really go over very well when he first started talking about that last year. Of course, he's adding mobile, which is something that we think, again, is likely to fail in court, something that Congress can do and that Republicans have offered to do. And then finally, there are those there's that catch-all where the FCC seems to be claiming authority over any kinds of harm. It's not clear what that means, but that could turn into really the key provision and end up doing a lot of the work here. And it could end up being used to regulate things like zero rating plans, things that are really not net neutrality issues, but that some of the people pushing the FCC to go hardline have been concerned about and have been complaining about since 2010 when MetroPCS tried to offer free YouTube as part of its starter plan targeted at urban underserved populations. So we'll see. And then finally, the FCC doesn't really seem to justify a ban on paid prioritization at all. I don't think we're likely to see much analytical work from them on that. Jeff, do you want to add anything here to the content of the rules?
I just want to amplify the CPNI point, going back to Gordon's and Jim's questions. I think if we're going to see any kind of enforcement or sort of aggressive, proactive activity by the FCC, that's where we're most likely to see it, and that's particularly troubling and problematic. And then just to amplify your point about the catch-all, I think the we'll have to wait to see what the rules actually say, but because there was this commercially reasonable limitation essentially imposed by the courts when these rules were going to be enacted under Section 706, there was at least some sense that that there was a kind of cost-benefit analysis there, that things that had commercially reasonable justifications couldn't simply be thwarted by the FCC. Now that they've moved to Title II and have no need to impose that kind of limitation or have that limitation imposed by the courts, it really does open them up to doing just about anything they want. And I do agree with Barron that the risk that this will be expanded to content providers is substantial. Certainly, I think we're likely to see rules that effectively permit that, which means ultimately, as Barron mentioned, we're in the world where, as that Jeff Polberg described, where the scope of these rules is entirely up to three commissioners.
Just briefly on the CPNI point, because this is confusing, just want to make clear that the CPNI rules would apply directly only to broadband providers. The concern is that the way that the statute is written, it talks about them having a duty to protect information and not make it available unless it's protected by the rules. And Congress meant that, of course, to cover telephone companies and to make sure that telephone companies didn't sell your information to data brokers. But the FCC could potentially interpret that to say, for example, that AT&T's wireless network makes available sensitive private information to Uber every time that Uber runs on your phone. And so Uber could end up getting sucked into the FCC's rules in addition to having to deal with the Federal Trade Commission. And that really could be quite burdensome to the very edge companies that have been pushing for net neutrality protection. And it remains to be seen how other companies may end up getting sucked into Title II more generally. I'd like to wrap up and just take any final questions we have from the audience. But while we're taking a cue, I'll just briefly touch on the Muni Broadband issue. This is also being put up, of course, on the February 26th meeting. I think the two things are likely to be tied together politically and potentially legally in the future. And I've already mentioned that underlying the broadband fight is the question of whether 706 really can reasonably be interpreted as an independent grant of authority, as the FCC claimed in 2010. We don't think so. We think that the court really should ultimately strike that down. But they may or may not actually resolve that issue, because the other big question is the federalism question. Even if 706 is ambiguous and therefore subject to deference under Chevron, under federalism, the analysis is completely different. The question is not, is it ambiguous, but rather, is it unmistakably clear? And it's hard for me to see how it can be both ambiguous and also unmistakably clear as evidence of Congress's intent to supersede the authority of the states. And you don't have to take my word for it, because we already went through this before. The FCC tried to preempt state laws regarding muni broadband and lost back in 2004 using a section of the Act that was far more clear than Section 706 is. So I think it's about as likely as anybody could say anything is likely that the FCC will lose on muni broadband. And that also will kick the issue over to Congress, where, as I said earlier, Republicans and Democrats already voted for the Community Broadband Act as part of the 2006 update of the Communications Act. Senator Booker has introduced legislation along those lines today. I think there's the heart of a bipartisan compromise is in there. I would just want to make sure that when the law says cities can't discriminate against private providers, that means that they've got to make the infrastructure that they build, like dig one's conduits, available to anybody, and then finally that they give private providers an opportunity to use municipal infrastructure before assuming that private providers won't deploy. In other words, that it's all very well and good for cities to try to stimulate deployment by building dig one's conduits or putting up fiber-ready poles or leasing their own assets. But they really should be building their own network and running that really as a last resort, not as a first resort. And I think that there is the heart of a compromise there. And if Republicans do want to get net neutrality legislation done, they really will probably have to consider rolling this in at some point, because that's the only way to get Democrats to let go of this broad authority that the FCC has claimed under Section 706. So you could see those two things rolled together, and as Jeff said, they could be rolled into a larger update of the Communications Act, as happened back in 2006. If there are no further final questions, we'll wrap things up today. I'll give anybody who wants to a chance to put themselves in the queue, and if not, then we'll encourage all of you to come to our future events. We'll likely have an event right after the day after the FCC vote on the 26th to discuss what was actually said. And if you'd like to follow up with us, of course, you can simply email us at media@techfreedom.org. We're happy to discuss any of these things with you on the phone for as long as you like. Obviously, we don't mind talking. We encourage you to follow us both on Twitter, Baron Soka and Jeff Manny, Tech Freedom and Law Econ Center. We are engaged in all these issues all the time, and happy to talk them through with you in greater detail. So if there are no further questions, I will thank all of you for your time today, and Jeff for joining me. And I just personally will just say in closing that I've been doing this for 7 years, engaged in this field for 7 years, in the think tank world for five. I've been involved in the net neutrality fight since 2002 when Tim Wu described this idea in my internet law class, and I'd like to see this all resolved, and I think we can, and Congress can do that instead of leaving this all to the courts to fight over for the next 2 to 10 years. So let's see what happens, but thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks very much, everyone. Really appreciate it.